Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. I'm your host this week, David Gibney, and I'm joined by my co-host this week, Conor McCabe. The Week at Work is part of Left Block, an alternative media and political education project, and we'd love your support if you could possibly send it our way. You can go to patreon.com/leftblock, or you could actually just go directly to the leftblock.ie website if you want to find out more about us, read some of the articles that are up there, find some of our other podcasts, and engage through that. We're going to start this week, I think, talking to you, Conor. You've been on a little bit of a journey there the last couple of days. You've been over at the picket lines over in Coventry, is it, in the Amazon warehouse? Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, just for the last kind of 3 days, on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, there was a strike in Amazon Coventry, BHX4 is the name kind of given to it. Amazon name their warehouses after the nearest airport. So about 18 months ago, there was a meeting called in the canteen, and management called this meeting. And then at the meeting, they said, "We understand that there's a cost of public living crisis, and you've been such good workers that we're going to give you a 50p pay increase." Exactly. And all hell kind of broke loose, and a spontaneous walkout happened.
Ooh.
So the staff just, like, this wasn't kind of GMB, this was the staff themselves. They had a meeting in their canteen and said, "We're walking out. This is not going to accept them."
Right.
So they walked out, and
all of them.
Yeah, he ran the shift. Yeah.
Why?
Well, enough. I don't know whether it was absolutely everyone, but enough to more or less kind of, really disrupt like what's going on. And then from that, there was talk about kind of what to do. Some of the more experienced heads in the place said, "Well, listen, you need kind of union protection here, just to really kind of push this through." So then people started joining kind of GMB that, and then they had their first strike about a year ago. It was a fairly small kind of affair. But it was the first strike in Britain, in an Amazon kind of warehouse. And I was there in November as well. And, there was good numbers, but like for the last kind of 3 days, it was big. There was over 1,000 people out. Like, what Amazon have been doing is that, and maybe you can actually, can talk about this more, but like under British kind of label, under British kind of trade union law, you can get like recognized by the employer if you get a certain percentage of the workforce.
Yeah, as, 50 plus one.
Yeah. So what Amazon have been doing is that GMB quite quickly in a few months reached 50 plus one in terms of members. So Amazon hired nearly 600 more people.
That's brilliant.
Oh. And just to kind of really kind of mess things up, so GMB didn't call for the vote because, again, I'm not too au fait there with the laws, but if you call it once, then you can't call it for a few years or something. I don't know, but like but didn't call it anyway. So they went on kind of struck again, and they've been building up kind of numbers. And then after Christmas, so in January, Amazon hired another 300 people.
Whoa!
This is in January in like retail.
Yeah.
So it's obvious what Amazon are doing. They're just trying to avoid that 50 plus one vote happening. But GMB are keeping at it. They're working away. There's around 26 different languages spoken in the warehouse. It's a lot of kind of migrant work.
Yeah.
Look at Eritrea. Southern Asia, Middle East, Central and like Eastern Europe. So they've had issues around kind of how to organize in a workplace where people don't all speak English and don't speak a shared language. So they've been using like Google Translate. Like the innovations that they've been doing are
brilliant.
Are kind of really interesting. And objectively, but to go from a few dozen members to well over 1,200 now in the space of like 14, 18 months in anyone's book, that is quite an achievement. So it's a real, you know, there was a real energy just over there. Why I was there was I'm working on a research a report based out of Queen's University, and it's on e-commerce retail warehousing in Britain. And so Amazon is part of that. It's not really about Amazon, but obviously kind of it's the industry kind of leader, so we do kind of some work on it. So I was over there, I was that guy on the picket line standing there asking, I kind of talk to people. So that was
brilliant.
I love doing that. It is not. I am back at shop. It's not my thing. But I got about a dozen kind of interviews anyway, you know. So so it's pretty good, like, you know.
But can I ask you what are the conditions? What are the conditions like for those workers at the moment? Like, is it minimum wage generally? And
part of the reason why a membership is going up is that they're getting wins. They've gone from 10.50 an hour to I think 12.50 an hour starting in April. It's now £12 an hour. So they've won three pay increases of kind of 50p because Amazon's trying to shut this down. As far as I know, each warehouse has a certain amount of autonomy in terms of kind of setting wages. And now it's at £12 an hour, but they're arguing for £15 an hour. So it's 12.50 from April onwards.
Yeah. And just for context, the minimum wage in England is £10.42. So it's about 160 above the minimum wage, which is quite significant for a bad employer like Amazon.
It is. And to win that in like 12 months, you know, what Amazon kind of noticed is that, you know, there was a lot of the workers from Eritrea were getting involved in the union. So they, as far as what I can make out, Amazon actively went for workers who came from South Asia. They're trying to use the language as a barrier against organization, you know. So I raised that just to kind of highlight that these companies these are working 24/7 on how to bus unions.
Yep.
They're not approaching how to bus unions in a way that normal people do, that when it comes up in the conversation, how would you bus the union? No, that's not what they're doing. And then it's kind of write down the first five thoughts in your head. No, I mean, you know this, of course, but like, you know, they've got, there's a full-time job for hundreds of people working now 24/7, how to break union membership, how to break union organization. So, but GMB are also quite kind of nimble footed here as well. So it's an interesting dynamic that is going on. On the picket line, back in November, you could see that, you know, there was a lot of workers who were, you know, involved in the chanting and, like, you know, no work today and you know, stopping cars, you know, with workers who were driving in and trying to persuade them to kind of join the union. But there was also, it was also kind of reps and kind of officials as well. This time, it's only like, 3 months later, it was overwhelmingly, it was the workers themselves. So you see that part of their kind of strategy now is that what they found in using the apps for like translation is that apps translate words, but they don't translate meaning. So let's say, so a lot of meaning is in flexing the voice. It's in body language. It's all of those things. So they found that we need to get kind of native speakers and get them to kind of, you know, do these things. They produced leaflets in six different languages. You know, like from an organizational point of view, like, it is really interesting just seeing, you know, how much energy the GMB and West Midlands has, you know, Birmingham and the Midlands.
Six languages. I mean, immediately I went back to our discussion about James Connolly. What you need is a trade union official who's going to go out there and learn all those languages himself, really. But it's very impressive. I mean, with all the tools we have today, it's fantastic. Can I ask another question about it? Amazon, so that's a major warehouse that supplies the other warehouses. Are GMB organizing the other warehouses around the area as well, the smaller places?
Yes, they are. They had a one-day strike in the Birmingham one. So I was in Coventry, but the Birmingham one had its first strike last month. It wasn't a huge kind of turnout, but again, they're building. So just anyone who like Coventry and Birmingham, they're quite close. It's not quite Swords in Dublin, but you know, or Dublin City, I mean, but they are kind of quite close, about 15, 20 miles a difference, you know, mainly. So they're quite close. So they are kind of organizing more and more and more. And, you know, and I've no doubt that lessons learned from Coventry and from Birmingham will be applied like all across wherever, you know. So, no one's told me this, but I mean, just logic tells you that, you know, that they're strategizing here. It's obvious. You can't go from a few dozen members to nearly 1,200 just through sheer luck. That's bloody hard work, you know. And that's thinking things through, you know.
And it's getting those workers themselves to commit, because especially on a premises like an Amazon, like, you're not getting an official or an organizer in there to talk to the workers. So the workers are, and people miss this a lot of the time, the best organized workplaces are the ones that are organized by activists on the inside, obviously.
And that's what's happening. And that's what's happening in Coventry. You know, it's activist rep led, you know. So they're doing what Jay McAlevey always talks about, you know, find the natural leaders and headhunt them, you know.
Yeah.
Just get the natural leaders and headhunt them.
And probably using the community again, Jane McAlevey stuff, you know, the might not necessarily be the most outspoken in there, but find the person who's respected the most in there, find the leaders within their own communities. And that might mean, and I've experienced this when I was an organizer myself, of, you know, you have to talk to church leaders, you have to talk to people who have the ear of the leaders as well. So, it's a really difficult task when you are not allowed near a premises like that. Because there's a difference between trying to organize workers. Say, for instance, I can walk into any shop and start talking to workers. But these workers are in a warehouse. And to get into that warehouse, they either come in by a bus or by cars. And how do you stop a car going in to have that conversation? So it's a really difficult space to organize that I don't think people appreciate. It's not someone, you're not just going to bump into someone from Amazon, other than maybe the delivery drivers, you know, and ask them to go back in and bring in your flyers and leaflets. So it's a huge challenge. We know that from, you know, I even trying to organize IKEA 15 years ago and being told you have to stand on the M50 if you want to talk to IKEA workers and hope that they stop as they're entering the premise, because IKEA own the land on the way in. So you're not allowed, you know, near it. So I can imagine how bad it is with a company with the reputation of Amazon.
And as a good friend of ours, like Gareth Murphy, you know, kind of once said, you know, kind of trying to organize, if you know, kind of like financial workers in the IFSC, and trying to walk down, even get onto the streets of the IFSC as a trade union kind of official, like, you know, like same thing, you know, sometime again on the cars, like, that was interesting because the police were out. I was calling them the guards. They were kind of going, it's going, those bleeding guards over there, they're going, who? What? But
Garda Síochána.
Like the police, like, it's interesting again that, you know, Amazon aren't fighting this battle on their own. They have to stay on their side as well.
Yeah.
And you see that on a picket line. Like, well, I do anyway. I mean, again, like, I'm not an official. I've never worked as one. You know, I am very happy. I firmly believe in staying in your comfort zone. I think that's, like, that's just wellness horseshit about being outside of your comfort zone. No, stay in it. And my comfort zone is research and and kind of all these things. But like, it was interesting for me to be on that kind of picket line and seeing the police, when like they have the right in Britain, as I'm sure here, that to stop and talk to kind of potential members as they're going in. But as they're driving in, they were stopping cars now, and that was leading to a tailback. And it's just off one of the dual kind of carriageways. So the tailback, it was starting to affect a substantial part of kind of Coventry. So the police were in and they were moving people on, and they were like, even Dublin officials were saying to them, I've got a right to speak to these workers. The police were doing what police tend to do, is that they would break the law and then it's up to you to sort it out by some judge kind of afterwards, if you even kind of go that far. This idea that the police will stop breaking the law when it's pointed out to them that they're actually breaking the law is just a middle-class fantasy. You know, that's not what happens. Police will actively push it, and know that the onus is on you. After this is all over, 6 months down the line, to make an argument about the merits or otherwise of what happens on a cold kind of Tuesday morning. You know.
Yeah. No, my experience on picket lines and in disputes with the Gardaí is initially they can be okay until I suspect they get word from headquarters that they need to be harder on you as well. But with a company like Amazon and with police, probably I don't know a huge amount about the police
actually,
in that area.
That does kind of play out, because it was a 3-day strike. So on the Tuesday, the guards were very, very kind of heavy handed. On the Wednesday, they weren't at all. Was a guy who seemed to be playing a fair, so the rank sergeant maybe, but the rank he was in charge of it, he was letting the officials do their job with room for it. If they were taking the piss, he would tell them, now come on, it's time to kind of get these cars kind of moving, but he's being fair about it. And then on the Thursday, have you ever seen Whitnail and I?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. Another bit, near the end, where can Whitnell, he gets arrested for kind of drink driving, and there's a skinny kind of policeman saying, get in the back of the van, and he's shouting it. He's a little fucker, you know. That guy, he was in charge. It's like he was just an absolute bollocks, and right. He was loving it. You could see it in him, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he was getting. He loved. Yeah. He just loved the whole power. So, yeah. But like, so you're dealing with the state then as well, and the state is not impartial when it comes to strikes.
Especially a Tory government that's been in place for 14 odd years, is it? 14, 15 years?
Yeah, 2010. Yeah. So this is the 14th year of it now. And so I think some of that did happen. On Wednesday, there was a, like, they were actually saying, by that policeman, he was grand, he was good, like, you know, and they were saying, on the Wednesday, they were saying, we'll probably never get him again. And sure enough, on the Thursday, it was getting the back of the van guy, you know?
Yeah. Just for context as well, you know, when you're hearing those figures of £12 an hour, I just Googled it there very quickly to have a look. But like last year, it's reported that Amazon took in 170 billion in revenue. I mean, the numbers are just astronomical. What's the Irish state's entire tax take? It's about 70 billion, isn't it? 75 billion, maybe. So it's twice the entire income of the Irish state.
It's the same amount as the amount of fucks which Leo gives about workers.
So yeah,
it's the same round figure.
Yeah, and like, again, in the same article that's in the Guardian there, they're expecting to go from profits of 4.8 billion. Like, it's just, it's crazy money. It's that monopoly money. They're expecting to go from that up to 8 to 12 billion. That's the expectation for last year from when they get the final report. But it's
very much so, yeah. Like, the initial figure is at 8 billion, and that will, like, you know, I just said there, like that will go up, you know.
And all of that is because of those union busting plans and strategies that they apply everywhere across the world. There isn't a country in the world that Amazon operates in that they don't have a plan about union busting in. Now, if, you know, it's an old saying, but, you know, if unions were ineffective, why would they have to spend so much money on them, on union busting? So it is a fair play to the GMB for pushing it and keeping going, because it's a very difficult industry and company to organize against. So I'd be interested to see what's going on the rest of the world on the Amazon stuff. And
placing you under arrest.
That'd be ridiculous. I haven't done anything. Look here, my cousin's a QC.
Get in the back of the van!
But, like, you know, on that, I mean, you know, on the state and kind of legislation, there's a bill up in like 2 weeks time in the free state, no less.
In the free state, yeah.
That deals with these things.
Yeah, and it's a bill that deals with union busting. So it'll be interesting to see what way the government and all of the parties go on.
Yeah, so what is the bill? So what is it?
It's Joan Collins has drafted a bill called Trade Union Deductions at Source. I can't remember if that's the exact name. Protection of Trade Union Subscriptions Bill, I think it's called. What it is it provides workers with the right, a couple of rights. One, the right to sign up to a union and have their employer pass on the union fee from their wages. So it's actually an old system that used to be in play, you know, decades and decades ago, and the vast majority of trade union members, their employer would pay it and then deduct it from their workers' wages. It's very similar to the Pensions Act from, I think it's 2002, where if you decide you want to join a pension, and this is why it'll be a good indication to see where the state is on this. The state is trying to deconstruct our entire social welfare and pension system, right? So what they do is they try and force people into a private pension scheme, and they facilitate those pension deductions on the employer by saying, when an employee comes to you and asks for a pension deduction, you must, by law, pass it on within 21 days, remit it to the pensions trust and the trustees of that pension fund, right? So that's what a state does when it wants to support a process like the deconstruction of our social welfare system, right? But what it does, what's going to be very indicative here to see where their perspective lies is exact same procedure, deduct. When a worker signs a form and says deduct £4 or £5 from my wages and pass it on to my union, then the employer would have an obligation to do so, right? So that's one element of what the bill does. Another element is, because it is a strategic union busting plan that's been adopted by multiple companies over the past 20 years, right? And it's a coordinated plan. I've no question about this because I've seen multiple multinationals utilizing it. Where you have a deduction at source system in play, and the employer hands over the details, the threat comes in from them that if you go on strike, we're going to stop the deductions at source. That'll soften the cuff of the old trade union who's threatening to strike for cuts to wages or whatever else. So it does have an influence over workers in that sense. And I've seen it happen myself in certain companies where a workplace has gone on strike and immediately had their deduction at source removed. Another tactic that they use, employers, is they do the deductions from the worker. They pass that money on to the union, but they don't tell the union which member the money came from. So the union has to guess which member it came from, or wait until that worker comes to them and say, I need servicing, I've got an issue here, or they have to show their pay slip. So this piece of legislation, again, will force the employer to pass on the details. Another union busting tactic is that, as you know, time goes by and union subs increase in an employment, I'll name this one, Dunn Stores. They have refused to increase the subs for the members concerned. And therefore, those workers will end up in arrears and won't have the right to representation if the union sticks rigidly by its books. And maybe the union or the worker then has to pay off all those arrears before they can be serviced. So the reason, you know, I'm talking 3 to 4 multinational retailers and companies, other companies as well, who are utilizing this union busting tactic. It's clearly a tactic. It's clearly a strategy. So here's a little piece of legislation, very simple, By the way, we do have it in the contract cleaning registered employment agreement, right? The statutory instrument that was signed by Minister Damien English there only in 2022 provides for when a worker wants to have a deduction, they can pass it on. But will they bring it in as primary legislation is the question here. And I'd argue that we're fighting an uphill battle here. But you have to fight these battles and see where yeah. each of the parties lies. So one of the other things to say about it is, and maybe we'll do a specific show on this topic now in the next couple of weeks, because I think it's an important one. But we've got the EU directive on adequate minimum wages, right, coming in. And that directive is already, you know, sanctioned by the EU, has to be transposed into Irish law by November. And with it, just to give a very short synopsis of it, any country in Europe that has trade union coverage levels, collective bargaining coverage levels less than 80% has to show, their government has to show a roadmap of increasing that coverage or increasing the minimum wage to make sure there's adequate living standards going on, right? We don't know where the Irish government is going to go with this, but the bill that Joan Collins has drafted, and the directive says this, countries must take action to stop union busting. So this is a measure to stop union busting. So will the Irish government support a piece of legislation that actually helps them to achieve the goals of the EU directive for a country that's constantly saying, we love the EU, the EU is the best thing since sliced bread. Will they actually live up to their own standards around their love of the EU and their directives, you know?
So I don't, is any kind of mood music out there, you know, when, you know, in terms of the parties or the kind of trade unions, like?
From the union perspective, yeah, there's been a couple of unions that have gone on the record to support the piece of legislation. The legislation right now only really affects the private sector. It doesn't affect a large proportion of the public. It doesn't affect the public sector at all, because that system is in play in the public sector. There's no part of the public sector that would stop a deduction at source and threaten and do all the rest of it. It's unheard of. So this is really a private sector issue. And I don't know what the figures are in the public sector in terms of density, but it's probably 50 to 60%, probably more, 60, 70% density. But the private sector is about 10 to 12% density. Yeah. So if you want to increase your coverage, this is the sector of the economy that you have to go after. In terms of the parties, it's going to be very interesting. I don't know. I expect all of the opposition parties will support this. Yeah. But Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens is the question. And the debate will be Tuesday week, the 27th, is it, or 28th? It's that week. It might be the Wednesday, Tuesday or Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So that's when we'll sort of get an indication, because this was only moved as first stage on Tuesday just gone. So the government are probably just reviewing the pieces of legislation at the moment. They'll take a position in the next week or two, and so will the other opposition parties. I have raised it with a number of parties, including Sinn Féin, who I think we might get on to talk about now in a second as well. But I haven't actually, and now I didn't look for a commitment immediately. I didn't ask straight up, but I did meet with some Sinn Féin people and asked them, you know, or filled them in about the bill. So we'll see where that goes. But I'd expect support from Sinn Féin. I'd be very surprised if they don't support a bill like this. Sinn Féin in the polls have dropped significantly, according to every media outlet and according to every polling outlet over the last couple of weeks. You've been looking into some of this stuff and you have a couple of perspectives that you want to share. What is happening with the polling?
Well, I mean, like, as a brief kind of overview, because, you know, just in case people haven't been kind of, covering it, Sinn Féin have dropped in the polls from around 32 to 33%, sometimes 24%, down to what seems to be now 24%. So it's a substantial drop that's way outside any margin of error. You know, I mean, you're talking like 10 percentage points. That's 10 percentage points, but really it's about 30% of their support has left in the last kind of 12 months. So that's really what that's really what is kind of talking about. So that's kind of substantial. And there's a lot of theories out there, and they are theories. And I think this is worth kind of highlighting. There's a lot of theories out there as to why this is happening. I think what's like it is worth kind of like we're going into an election season now, or there'll be three. There's two referenda on the same day. There's the local elections. There's European elections, and there'll probably be a general election before the end of the year. They could go until January, until Feb 2025, but they'll probably go either just after the budget or just before. So we're looking at like now we're into the voting season, like so to speak. Based on these figures, Sinn Féin should do very well in the local and European elections because they did so badly last time. In like 2019, Sinn Féin got around 11% of the vote in the locals and in the European kind of elections, even on kind of 24%, even if that slips to kind of 20, even if it's 18%, they should still make substantial kind of gains. In terms of the European elections, where their vote is strongest, if you get into the regions, they're at 32%. Even in these polls, that has them at, like in the latest Red Sea poll, they're at around 32% in like Connacht, Ulster, and around kind of 30% in the south as well. Where they're losing votes seems to be that it is some loss of votes outside of Dublin, but they're losing Dublin, and that's kind of and that has more that has more that has more of an impact in terms of the general election because just because of the multi-seat constituencies and the nature of Dublin, you really need Dublin if you want to form a government, and that's the space that that we're in now. It's no longer about Sinn Féin building itself up to be the main kind of opposition. It's done that. Now it's about power, and if it wants power, it needs to hold on to Dublin and kind of build up in Dublin. On the latest kind of Red Sea polls, Fine Gael are the most popular party in Dublin. But I've kind of jumped ahead just a small bit. Based on the poll on the Red Sea poll, Sinn Féin should get two MEP seats for Dublin for Ireland Northwest, I think it's called. They should get two seats in Ireland South, and they should get one seat in Dublin. So they're running two candidates in each one. So they're running six candidates in the three European constituencies. Ireland has gained one seat, and that's gone to Ireland Northwest. So they have one there. That's the person that was kind of McCarthy. I don't know who
Chris McManus.
he's the sub. Okay, but they should pick up two in like Ireland South. So for me, that for me is what would tell the like, tale. What they should get as at a minimum. What they should get is five seats, two in Dublin North, in Ireland Northwest, as far as I know. It's
Yeah.
north, yeah, it's Ireland
North
Northwest.
and West, probably.
Yeah, Ireland South two, and then one in Dublin, either Ed Liam Boylan or who's the councillor again? Who's
Dahi Doolan.
one of them should get in. But having said that, in the last kind of Red Sea poll, they were higher up in the Irish in the Ireland kind of things one. But in the latest Red Sea poll, which is it is pretty, it's a robust, it's a good poll.
Right.
Red Sea take that job fairly seriously, and they do good work. I mean, these are all polls, but they do work hard at it. Like it's a solid one. It has kind of credibility for a reason, and they're on 18% in Dublin at the moment. That they're not going to get two MEP seats on like 18%, and they mightn't even get one if the vote splits and doesn't transfer. So there's a bit of a risk there as well. But having said that, they should get one in Dublin. So we have this situation now. This is my long-winded way of saying that. We have the situation where the story is that Sinn Féin have like lost votes, but they're going to actually do well this year, based on the fact that they did so badly back in 2019. But the second part is that is the reasons, well, why they're losing votes.
Yeah.
And Ireland's media has come very quickly to the conclusion that it is immigration, with no evidence for this. Because if you look at the polls, Sinn Féin is not losing votes to, like, there's no massive kind of gain for like independence, which is where you'll see that kind of far right vote. That's gone from 12 to like 15%. It's been some kind of kind of bleed over. Some of it has gone to Sock Dems. It was still, and I'll go on record now. I can't see how they're on 6%. I think they're on higher. It doesn't make sense to me that they're on 6%. But they are. So we have this thing that the media story is that it is immigration. So sorry,
Well, just on that, right? Because I
it is
sorry.
immigration. But there's no evidence has been put forward as to this is the reason why Sinn Féin are like losing votes.
Well, now this has me a bit curious because I'm looking at two different polls here. I'm looking at the Red Sea poll where you're right, the independents haven't gone up by that much, right? They're at 15%, but they're only up from about 12, 13 actually about a year ago. But on the maybe this is an Irish Times thing, but on the Irish Times Ipsos poll, the independents have gone from 16 to 25. Now, when you dig a bit deeper and look at it, they've put independents stroke others. Who's in the others? Sock Dems. So they've put Labour Party separately. Now, why would you put Labour Party in on its own, but not the Sock Dems? Sock Dems are a much bigger party in the Parliament at the moment than Labour are. So why lump Sock Dems in with the independents unless it's to back up your own contention that this is a far right thing? Because everybody knows that's where the far right are. They're in the independent section. Well, so are
And the
lefties
and
as well.
yeah, and you know, and the far right are in the Sock Dems. Is this what kind of Irish Times is saying, you know? This gets into it. I'm not saying they don't have shares in like Red Sea, but it does do its job, and you got to respect the professionalism, you know. At the same time, polls are only a step above shaking an eight ball, you know, and just seeing kind of what comes up, you know. Sinn Féin, they were on 11% in like 2019, and less than 12 months later, they get 24% in the general election. You know what I mean? Like, so things are fluid anyway. But I think where we can dig into why Sinn Féin are losing votes is to look at, well, why did they gain votes? Why was it? And there's no way that Sinn Féin gained votes in the last from 2020 up to 2022 because they were seen as being strong on immigration, and they're seen as being soft. They're losing votes because, well, we can say anything really, because like you know there's as much evidence for anything I'm going to say now as it is for the other. Where I think we can be a bit more credible is looking at, well, why did people vote for Sinn Féin, or why are they saying Sinn Féin needs to be in the government? And time again, what came up was cost of living, housing, health services. And I think what's happened is that if there's an issue, it's probably in that sphere that is going on. I'm not saying that they haven't lost some votes in terms of kind of immigration, because the media is really kind of building this up. Like, you know, you've got far right kind of fascists who are getting front page news, are getting kind of interviews way out of kind of proportion to their size and their influence. And I think part of the reason is that the media has come to the conclusion that that immigration is Sinn Féin's soft underbelly. This would probably this probably is borne out with some facts, because when you look at the breakdown in terms of the question of kind of immigration, the voter cohort who wants more kind of controls on immigration are Sinn Féin voters. But that's after they've lost they've lost, you know, kind of so many. So if anything, those who want more controls have stayed with Sinn Féin. If those who like if those if voters if the 10%, if the 30% of Sinn Féin support that has gone in the last kind of 12 months, if that was down to kind of immigration, then why are the polling as the highest number, as the highest percentage of voters? Those who are left are probably the reason why Sinn Féin is getting 75% of their voters say that kind of immigration is an issue is because they've stayed with Sinn Féin. The ones who have left for other reasons or have said we're not so strong on kind of Sinn Féin. If those who were strong on immigration had left, then that they wouldn't be polling higher than Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, and kind of other parties in terms of we need to be stronger. There has been a concentration now because those who have left don't think that's a huge issue. They think that the other things are. And that's where Sinn Féin hasn't fallen down. Like where have kind of Sinn Féin been on health and housing in the last, you know, on kind of cost of living in the last kind of 12 months? There is a clear issue in terms of ideas in what is the leadership of like Sinn Féin now. And I think that's the issue. You can say that it's immigration, but the immigration people seem to have stayed. Those who have left seem to have had other concerns, and they're not coming back until those concerns are being kind of addressed. That was a long rant, sorry.
No, it's good. It's interesting to look at it that way and the way it's portrayed in the media, because a large part of where we're gonna what we're gonna see over the next couple of months is very well, we can expect a very a lashing of Sinn Féin and other left candidates. Claire Daly said it 2 weeks ago at the event she held in the Smock Alley Theatre, that she, you know, the first there was an article that week in the Irish Times saying effectively again that she was a Putin puppet, and that she's expecting a lot more of that over the next couple of weeks.
What we can say is that if like immigration is the issue, the poll seems to suggest that they're actually staying with the party, and those who are leaving over kind of issues. They can say kind of, you know, kind of lack of like clarity on policy. I do think that Palestine has hurt them. Now I have no evidence. Again, I have no evidence for this. But just knowing people who are saying whatever, I'm not too sure about them because, like, if Sinn Féin are on the wall, because they were sitting on the fence in terms of like Palestine. The one party that Palestine should be a fucking no-brainer for is kind of Sinn Féin, and they were being kind of outplayed by kind of Fine Gael and by Fianna Fáil on the issue, and Labour and the Soc Dems, especially the like Soc Dems.
But you wonder how much when we look at like polls in the past, and I'm going back 10, 15 years in my head of it, you know, in the run up to a budget or any of them, and any other polls, right? The issues that people are voting on tend to be healthcare, housing, education, stuff like that, right? So Palestine doesn't tend to be right up there. So you'd imagine that, yeah, they might get a be damaged, not just damaged in the polls slightly from it, but will that translate in the run up to an election, or are people going to revert back to healthcare, housing, education? What I would have felt, and again, no evidence to prove this, but I'd like to see the amount of times that Eoin Óibríon has been in the media in the last 12 months versus previous years. Because I think there's been a big decline in the amount of times he's been out there, and he was a large part, in my opinion, for the winning of the housing issue for
Completely,
Sinn Féin.
completely. He was the sole reason for it.
So
Completely.
with high profile people like himself, not like I heard him the other day, he has been on the media. I just there was a period there for a while where every housing discussion had Eoin Óibríon on it, and it wasn't a proper housing discussion. If you didn't have Eoin Óibríon on it, people would laugh at it, going, "That guy, Dara O'Brien, hasn't a clue what he's talking about." So I do think that a large part of this has been down to or potentially being down to certain people within the party, Sinn Féin, not being as prominent in the mainstream media as they had been in the past. I've no evidence to prove it, but I think that could be it. The other thing is, I know what you're saying about Red Sea and them being very professional and all the rest of it. I still think the margin of errors are too tight on some of these polls. I do think, like, they didn't predict the general election to the degree, the one in 2020, the first the election that year. They weren't close to it. So, I mean, and a large
But like, you know, neither was kind of Sinn Féin.
No, I know. Yeah, that's why they didn't run enough candidates because of the polling.
So, like, you know, so, like, again, I'm kind of making your point for you, but which I apologize for. But like, you know, it's interesting that people start thinking back on these issues in the last kind of 3 weeks before the general election, and that'll be the proof in the pudding. But if what is happening now, which is what the media is doing, where they're trying to shoehorn Sinn Féin into making the next general election about kind of immigration. If they do, Sinn Féin will suffer.
Yeah.
Because what people want is hearing Sinn Féin talking about health, housing, childcare, infrastructure, education, these issues. And if they're being told, and if they panic, which they are doing, and just focus in on okay, immigration, then it's a real issue.
I think people are so strapped financially, healthcare system is in bits, housing, I really think that these are going to be the core issues. And the question is whether, which parties can communicate a real solution and an alternative. Because, you know, immigration, I actually, now that you've said it, I think there are certain cohorts of this country that are going to really, and I don't mean the far right, that are really going to push immigration, because that is the weak link they see on.
They see that like I have no doubt, going back to the Amazon thing around how they strategize, you know, 24/7, the state is strategizing on how to make make kind of Sinn Féin house trained. You know, for government.
The hotel up in your area is a really good example of this.
Where does Sinn Féin have a chance of getting 3 seats? They have a real chance. They should run country candidates, and they'll get 3 seats here. They will get 3 seats in Loud, even on that figure of 24%. They will get kind of 3 seats here. And what did he do? 500 people into the Big D kind of hotel.
Yeah, and the people who suffer for that is not Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil.
No.
So strategically, it makes sense to kickstart that outrage in relation to that issue up in an area like that. But it's spread. It's everywhere else now. Like I had a phone call from somebody yesterday saying it to me. This is going to be a disaster for those of us who are fighting against the far right here. It's so much ammunition there.
I'm not saying it's easy for Sinn Féin to avoid this, but if they can allow themselves to be corralled into what the media want the next election to be about, they're fucked.
But I don't even think the media need to go after Sinn Féin, or the opposition need to go after Sinn Féin on this. They just raise that issue.
Yeah, that's
and allow, it's like winding the clock and just let it run then. Let the thing strike 10, 12 itself. We don't need to do much after this. So stir people up, let them off. That seems to be the strategy that's going on at the moment around this topic. So,
and then just on the final line, you know, could just say again that, like, given all, like, it's going to be weird that given all of the polls, Sinn Féin are actually going to have a good year this year in terms of kind of the locals and the Europeans. They go down to 18% and still have a much better local and like European kind of, you know, kind of election campaign. So there will be room for them to bounce back and say, no, we want this to be kind of assertive and say, we want this to be about health, housing, services, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll keep our eye on this.
Whether they do or
one.
Not, who knows? You know?
Yeah. We'll, and no doubt we'll be back talking about some of these issues as well again in the next couple of weeks. I think we'll wrap up there if that suits. So look, this has been the week of work. I want to thank Connor for his valuable insight as always. We're part part of the Left Bloc project again, just to reiterate it. We're going to be having events later on this year again, so please do support us, because the Patreon supporters are going to get first preference and first dibs at those tickets. Go to leftbloc.ie or to patreon.com/leftbloc, and we'll talk to you all again next week.